And hi, everyone. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's April 16th, the weekend anniversary of our Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Day, and you're listening to Here We Stand. Well, someone asked me just last night, actually, Kevin, what does this day mean for you exactly? And, of course, the things that matter most to us are often very difficult to put into words. But some words came to mind, and some of the words that occurred to me were from a World War I veteran, Rupert Brooke. And he wrote after the war, "Oh, how they stood in battle array, I shall always remember to my dying day." And that twigged something for me, because I, too, will always remember how a long line of mostly homeless, destitute Native men and women followed me without hesitation into the Catholic Cathedral in Vancouver that we occupied on that great day in April 2008 that made history. Because as the priests fled in fear out the back door and we seized the pulpit and spoke to the dumbstruck parishioners of their church's slaughter of children, the power of that ancient evil also fled. Because that same month, Christian Canada began admitting for the first time to its Indian residential school genocide. Well, we won a great victory that day, our unlikely army of poor people, especially a victory for our hope and our morale because it kept us going. But we also paid a high price for our victory, because as always, our enemy struck back. William Coombs was killed by arsenic poisoning in St. Paul's Catholic Hospital. Bingo Dawson and Ricky LaValle were beaten to death by Vancouver police. Harriet Nahani was murdered in Surrey Remand Prison. Ron Barber was killed by a hit-and-run driver. Harry Wilson was knifed to death. Edna Phillips died of drug poisoning. And many others simply vanished. But the unrelenting spirit of our people that brought down that Roman Goliath momentarily has continued in those of us who are still alive and willing to act. Those great souls still live on in us. That spirit fought on and eventually brought down a pope and sparked a global revolution to combat the corporate-led genocide that's now threatening all of us. And one of the stalwart fighters who's carrying on the torch raised by our fallen friends is an elderly woman in Wollongong, Australia. Her name's Georgina Cameron. Georgina is doing what everyone else in her town refuses to do by facing down the oldest crime on our planet, called the Roman Catholic Church. As we did on that radiant day in Vancouver, Georgina is leading by example by personally confronting the child killers in robes. She single-handedly occupied Catholic churches and set up display boards on their front steps. She's demanded and petitioned that the local Wollongong City Council cancel all tax exemptions for the criminally convicted transnational criminal body known as the Roman Catholic Church. And she's recruited homeless people to help her take over church buildings as part of the common law banishment and reclamation order issued against the Vatican. But as a result, Georgina is also paying a price for her courageous leadership, because just 2 days ago, she was physically attacked and beaten up by a 7-person goon squad led by 2 church members, even though she's 69 years old and semi-disabled. But like all pure souls, Georgina isn't deterred by such sick and cowardly cruelty, and she's still fighting on. She's embodying that eternal spirit that's stronger than death, and that's calling out to each one of us now to recover ourselves and break away from our complicity with evil. And so in one of our upcoming shows, we're going to be featuring an exclusive interview with Georgina. Well, she's an example of the similar actions that are occurring today at Catholic, Anglican, and United churches all over Canada and all over the world, and that will continue in the weeks ahead. Not just actions of the churches, but as I mentioned, the nullifying of tax exemptions and privileges for these convicted criminal bodies. And so today on our show, we're going to be going into more of that courage under fire and how it's continuing in our upcoming campaigns that are commencing this month and are going to carry through right to the fall. I'm joined today by my fellow fighter, Owen Lucas from Ireland, who's part of our Global Republic Alliance movement. And this is from an interview we did just 2 days ago, the same day that Georgina was attacked. We're here today and every Sunday on Here We Stand to inspire you to action, not to passive reflection. What you miss out by doing nothing against the evil in your own backyard is the great power and special love that's known by those who are united in a life and death struggle against institutionalized evil. And I want to quote another soldier, a Vietnam veteran named Phil Caputo. And he wrote a book called A Rumor of War, one of the classics, early classic novels, but accounts of the Vietnam War. And he wrote this: "I've also attempted to describe the intimacy of life in infantry battalions, where the communion between men is as profound as any between lovers. Actually, it's more so. It does not demand for its sustenance the reciprocity, the pledges of affection, the endless reassurances required by the love of men and women. Unlike marriage, it's a bond that cannot be broken by a word, by boredom, or by divorce, or by anything other than death. Sometimes even death is not strong enough. Two friends of mine died trying to save the corpses of their men from the battlefield. Such devotion, simple and selfless, the sentiment of belonging to each other, was the one decent thing we found in a conflict otherwise known for its monstrosities. And yet it was a tenderness that would have been impossible if the war had been any less brutal. And that combination of brutality and great love and a sacred kind of solidarity that come together, you don't know that on the sidelines. You never experience it unless you do plunge in. So that's an offer that I make to all of you today as we go into this interview with Owen, and stand by soon to hear from Georgina. I invite you to take part in our movement. You can learn more, murderbydecree.com, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.org, and of course we're here every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern, at the bbsradio.com/herewestand. And also especially invite you to write to us, Republic National Council at protonmail.com, to get on board with taking actions against not just these criminal churches, but the whole corporatocracy and police state that we're all battling now that came right out of these genocidal attacks on children and on indigenous people. The methods were perfected in these death camps that are now being used on all of us. So I invite you to join us in the coming weeks in Vancouver at the William Coombs Memorial Park that we reclaimed right across from so-called Holy Rosary Catholic Cathedral that we occupied that day, in downtown Vancouver along the three guilty churches on Church Street, ending up at William Lyon Mackenzie House to commemorate one of our ancestors of our Republic movement in Canada, in New York City at the UN Plaza and St. Patrick's Cathedral, and a march that will occur there, in Dublin, Ireland at Pro Cathedral and the Dáil or the Irish Parliament, in London, where people will be rocking the coronation of King Charlie the Brainless on May 6th. Oliver Cromwell, come back, please. And in Australia, at the Lumen Christi Church, where they attacked our sister, Georgina Cameron, in the weeks ahead. That Catholic Church that, as you'll hear today in the interview, is closely linked, like in the west coast of Canada, closely linked to China and the expansion of that new empire. So here's the interview with me and Owen Lucas today. And we'll be back with more live next week. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. I thank you.
How's things? Is today the day? No, it's coming up.
Tomorrow is the day. I mean, really, the whole weekend is the day, the anniversary of our first Aboriginal Holocaust Memorial Day in Vancouver. 2005, it was such a memorable, beautiful day. I remember, I guess you've probably seen that picture of our first gathering.
Yeah. Well, I noticed Georgina had that picture behind her, right?
Yes. And I want to talk about Georgina. I'm not sure if you heard what happened to her. She was gang attacked and physically assaulted when she was trying to recruit some homeless people to help her with the church action. So we should really talk about that today. Because it shows you part of the price you pay when you take on these criminal churches, right?
Right. Yeah, and that's very recently. That's this week.
Yesterday it happened. I talked to her for an hour, and she gave me all the details. I urged her, like I did you, to relocate, you know, for her own safety right now. But this is unconscionable what they do to anybody. You know, this is a 69-year-old woman. Seven people assaulted her, led by two church goons. No, it's crazy.
Wollongong, Australia. And when you say goons, what kind of post positions were these guys?
No, it happened at a food bank line run by a church-affiliated group, ironically called Kind Hearts Illawarra. They distribute food to the homeless. But the two women who led the assault are connected to the church, Lumen Christi Catholic Church that Georgina occupied. Remember, she went in and did that action all by herself and got assaulted inside the church. They're just a half a mile down the road, and they're affiliated with this Kind Hearts food thing. So obviously it was pre-planned. and orchestrated, because there were seven people attacking her. Five of them had pretended to be friendly with her and invited her in. They grabbed the papers out of her hands. They pushed her. They were hitting her on the arm. You know, this is like a semi-crippled 69-year-old woman they're doing this to. She's all by herself. The police are only 200 feet away. They didn't respond to her calls. So clearly it was another orchestrated assault on one of our people.
Multi-agency.
Yeah. So it kind of reminded me of memories of these folks, because don't forget in this picture, there's three of our people who were killed. William Coombs, Bingo Dawson, and Ricky LaValle, all murdered because of these actions. So, I mean, it has that bittersweet memory going back 18 years. There's all of these great victories, but the price you pay, you know, at a human level, right?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, just watching that that movie, Spotlight, you know, the lawyer defending the victims, he's, what do you say, hypervigilant? I heard a really interesting one recently. People say I'm paranoid, but my question is, am I paranoid enough? You know, it's
right.
And you can feel the defensive rear guard action, right? So if they're doing that, there's a woman just out of a wheelchair, what do you say, late 60s, nearly 70, and she's on her own, and she's vocal and forthright and outspoken, and they're physically attacking her. Hey, what does that tell you about the state of?
You know, it reminds me so much of what happened to so many of the Native people who'd get up. I remember in my church in Port Alberni, the year they fired me, there was a woman, Krista Lynn, she was a mixed-blood Métis woman, that Sunday after they fired me for exposing this stuff, Krista gets up all by herself in church, and she says, "You're crucifying Kevin just like you crucified our people in the residential schools." At that point, two church goons grab her by the arm and physically throw her out onto the sidewalk. And she's like a 5'2" thin Native woman. And guess what? The next month she's found dead of, quote, a drug overdose, even though she never did drugs. I knew her very well. So, I mean, this is what happens when you take on these. They're not churches in the sense we understand them. They're part of this corporate machine, and they can't bear being exposed, especially nowadays, right?
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. And you know, we spoke about Canada last time, but Australia similarly. You know, I don't know if you've heard of this guy, Bill Heffernan, one of the senators there. He a couple of years ago came out with this report about the horrific child brutality, systemic child brutality, that he had evidence for, and the overwhelming watertight evidence that he produced, you know, just slams the whole. It's all over in terms of theory. It's just a case of when we the people want to do something about it.
We have in Australia, sadly, a compromise. At the highest of levels, there's a former Prime Minister on this list, and it is a police document.
They're nervous, right? They're on the back foot. They've got the itchy trigger finger kind of vibe.
Well, they've got the whole legal and political system so sewn up that people lose hope, because you can document it till you're blue in the face. The proof's all there, but then it's always shut down, and the people get away with it. An interesting thing in that regard about Australia, because like Canada, it's very sought after by China. China owns most of the resources in Australia now, like they do in the west coast of Canada. But this Kind Hearts charity that attacked Giorgini the other day, it's connected. One of its major funders is Energy Australia, which is an energy company owned by China Light and Power Company. And they're directly tied into the Catholic Church in Australia, because they're the big financial underwriters. They have billions of dollars. The Australian Catholic Church is really endowed because they're, like in Canada, funding the Vatican takeover. So there's a direct link between the people who assaulted Georgina and the Chinese and the Catholic Church. I mean, it's so blatant, right?
Right. And that money aspect can't be underestimated, right? You know, the psychological profile of psychopathy, you know, these murderous thugs are promoted to the positions where they're most, in inverted commas, effective to shut characters down like you and I and Georgina, right?
Well, Well, it's interesting. You know, one note of hope in all this is that their extreme defensive reaction, yes, shows we're getting close to the bone and they're very scared. When you're being assaulted and attacked by your enemy, it means they're on the defensive and they're afraid. But in a bigger sense, it also shows that, you know, one of the great things that we learned over the years in this campaign is what hope it gives. Just a few people getting together and taking these actions at the churches like we kept doing, it evoked an amazing shitstorm in Canada because they hadn't controlled the issue at that point. And they were just, their credibility was hanging down by the ankles, these churches. So it really excited. I remember whenever we do one of these actions, the thing that we did, you know, employing Sun Tzu is we never announced it. We just started walking along Hastings Street, which is the Skid Row area of Vancouver, where all the survivors and the eyewitnesses live, a lot of poor Native people. And they knew where we were heading, and they would follow our banner. You know, it said, all the children need a proper burial. We'd follow us, and then we'd turn towards the church we're going to hit. And the cops didn't know what to do, right, because they'd always be following. They didn't know what church we're going to hit. And we would continually catch them off guard because we never announced it. So it's that audacity and guerrilla tactics that kept putting them on the defensive all the time. Like, we would do something like that, then the government would announce a month later a healing fund program for survivors. Well, you know, like hush money to buy out the survivors. But it always followed right after our actions. And, you know, that sent a message to a lot of people that, look at the power we have, right? We just have to exercise it, like with the courage of Georgina or these folks, right?
And you hit the nail on the head there with controlling the narrative. They're absolutely desperate to control the narrative. I just saw one this week, which made me think about it. You triggered me thinking then. Elon Musk now has come out. There's a big sort of, you know, media hoo-ha about Elon Musk being rude about the British BBC. So the BBC is in free fall. You know, everybody is aware. They're having protests, you know, almost every weekend outside the BBC head offices because everybody's so disgusted with, you know, the standards of media, the malpractice. But to control the narrative, because they know the ship is sinking, they're going to sink it with one of their guys, Elon Musk, who seems like he's, you know, on the good guy's side by coming out and saying what everyone knows anyway. So
look at the power of that. We can move billionaire oligarchs follow our initiative. These poor homeless Aboriginal people set the pattern and the narrative for all the country. Now, that's one lesson the so-called rulers do not want us to learn. It means any one of us have, it's kind of like in physics, they say any particle in the universe has all the totality of the universe within itself. Yeah. Every human being is like that. We have totality within us. We just have to act on it, and we're unbeatable. So that's what I always say to people who are running after Trump or the latest, you know, Messiah who's going to take them to the promised land. Guys, you're forgetting your innate power by looking vicariously through somebody else. And that's one of the lessons out of our whole campaign that started many years ago, right?
Yeah, 100%. The holographic universe, right? That every single singularity has the totality within it. So that creates that potential, the energetic potential for the singularity to influence and transmute to the whole. And that creates a perception, a conception of immense power. For every individual, the power of the singularity, the power of one is a phrase you hear sometimes.
Right. You know, I remember I've got so many beautiful examples of that from memory of one of the times we were occupying Holy Rosary Cathedral. That's the Catholic Church. There was this old woman, Native woman called Maggie. And whenever you saw her in the street corner, she was a typical kind of drunk Indian, just a derelict. Okay. And yet she's there at the church and she comes alive. And there was a police barrier near the church and she starts dragging the police barrier across the road to block traffic as we had the church surrounded. And these cops came running up and they pointed their finger at her and say, "You stop this right now." And she said, like, "Screw you guys. Like, well, you should be arresting those people in the church for killing our children." And then the cop sergeant kind of puffed himself up and said, "Don't you know who I am?" And she looks him right in the eye and says, "You're just a guy in a blue suit." Right? And you could see the guy deflate. because he kind of realized that, oh, yeah, I'm just this man. Who am I working for? She's right. I don't want to admit it. And the guy turns around and leaves. And, you know, everyone's cheering Maggie, and she's so pumped up. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, you only know that when you do it, not when you hear about it. You got to be there. And then you're so empowered. That's why William gave up drinking after. And like why he was in the church, not afraid of these guys who had tortured him with cattle prods as a kid, because he's like, fuck you guys. I mean, we've got the power now, and that's the force that changes things, right?
Yeah, the forces pitched against us are brittle, right? And they evaporate. Wilfred Wong, you know, this brilliant child protection campaigner, his great quote was, shine a torch on them, shine a light on them, and they scatter like rats, right? Because they don't have the substance. They don't have the heart and the belief that, you know, holds any fortitude together, right? Yeah, you sparked my memory then when they hauled me into the police station before I left for Ireland, and I'd had a few experiences by this time to feel quite you know, confident or much more forthright and relaxed about, you know, being amongst them, shall we say. And there was this woman, very sort of officious and abrupt and short and rude to me, you know, attempting to play that matriarchal, you know, primary school teacher on me, and hoping that I'd, you know, feel that intimidation and buckle under. But I was over her shoulder as she was leading me through the police station, saying to her, TNCO, you work for a transnational criminal organization. And she was ruffled by it. You know, she knew that what I was saying had a lot of validity and truth to it. Yeah. And immediately tipped the tables. You know, she was, right. she you could see the fragility of the opposition.
It's called counting coup. The native people love using that practice and expression. Like, I don't know if you saw that movie, Dances with Wolves, about the American cavalryman out on the prairies with the Lakota. And there's a scene where he's standing there protecting his little post, and one of the Sioux or Lakota warriors rides up in full battle regalia, unarmed, and he's on his horse, and the U.S. cavalryman is holding the gun right at him, and the guy's unafraid on the horse saying, and he's saying in his own language, can you see I am not afraid of you? Can you see I am greater than you? And then he rides off unharmed. And that's exactly what you did. By doing that, you stand in the face of this overpowering machine and you say, we're greater than you. Your power is illusory. And then it goes, poof. That's why, you know, within a month of us occupying those churches, the government starts issuing apologies, right? Talking about fake inquiries and all this stuff into the missing children. And we forced that because we counted coup energetically. It's very easy to do, right? Very easy to do.
Yeah. And they had to control the narrative with that one. And they put a little, drop in the ocean number. What is it? 200. We've discovered that there was a little incident somewhere when, you know, the true figure is 60,000 plus, right? And they wanted to deflect it with a little number and a little incident, right?
That was a really brilliant example of official censorship and how it works. They went to the scene of the most heinous crime, the Kamloops death camp run by the Catholic Church, where they're doing a lot of experimental drug testing, big mass graves. We documented that for many years. So they go to the scene of the crime a few years ago. The RCMP announced they're doing an investigation, which is like the serial killer saying, I'm going to check under my house for bodies, right? And they announced, they never let anybody in to look at it. And they announced, oh yeah, we found about 200 bodies, right? And so that number, 215, emblazoned on everybody across the country to negate the 60,000 figure, like you said, right? And now that it's rewriting the narrative and reinventing the history all the time, like the memory, like George Orwell talks about, right? But it's only on the surface because they know the truth. The truth has this power all of its own, and it persists and it keeps popping up like grass everywhere, right?
Yeah. And that's that projection, the facade aspect where, like you say, it's like going to the serial killer and saying, you know, would you mind writing your account of how it happened, this kind of thing, whereby the people still have faith in the authorities, and they're writing to their MPs, or they're, you know, standing up in these council meetings, this kind of thing. Exactly the same point, that they're asking the culprits and the perpetrators, you know, to help them, you know, create a nurturing and healthy society, as opposed to creating those assemblies and the courts and putting those guys that they're hoping are going to care for them and help them, you know, in front of the jury. There's still that big step to take.
Well, you know, I think, you know, these experiences we have, they're really essential to pass on, but at the end of the day, people have to learn the lesson themselves. And so I'm, you know, often say to people that what we do, we're a catalyst to bring you into action. You can learn for yourself these lessons, right? Especially these days, I find, like, you know, when we go on about the whistleblower manual, which you found so helpful, it was taken out of these hard experience, hard won lessons at the church and in my own life and everything through loss. I only learned it through loss and suffering. And that brought it in because, you know, left to ourselves, we don't suffer. We don't risk. We secure ourselves. And that way you can't grow. I remember when we were sitting around the Sweetgrass Center in Vancouver planning our action, there was this old guy. He said, you know, we got to the level of talking about the meaning of life and all this stuff, right? And he said, well, I've learned that the meaning of life is to suffer. Because if you don't suffer, how do you ever learn? You stay quiet and happy and content. And that's why, you know, we got to break through that. And I learned that all the time. And I think that that's one of the great liberating things, losing that fear of death and suffering. Then you're unbeatable.
Yeah, 100%, and that's such a, you know, Sun Tzu, know your enemy. They know us, and they know that they've instilled into us this fear of, you know, switch off, the lights are going to turn off, and we're going to die, and that's a huge problem. And one of the great things you mentioned, the books, the Whistleblower Manual, and Establishing Reign of Natural Liberty, Common Law Training Manual, it gives you a historical context, and so. When I got hold of your books that time, as I mentioned in the previous one, 2016, 2017, it gave me that perspective over a long, long period. And you see again and again and again, when you look at how it's all unfolding over the centuries, that you go back to 1649, with the Levellers, and you get to Peterloo, the 1800s, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, the Irish independence struggles, 1920s, this kind of thing, that this is a developing progressive movement and paradigm shift that is improving, that they have to stay so subtle and so careful and hold on to that narrative as desperately as they can, because they can't do what they used to be able to do, which was just basically execute people in the street and say, look, you know, be afraid because we might do that to you if you raise your head above the parapet. And I think that I feel very strongly that whole COVID situation was very much that last chance saloon, where they were hoping to create that environment where they could just simply pluck people out of their homes, as they did with me, 2021, and throw you in an incarceration center of some sort. And then, you'd go missing and you'd be lost, and, you know, create that totalitarian fear environment situation that keeps everybody in line and in tow. But they've lost it. They've lost that potential to create what they were hoping to create out of the COVID narrative, and it feels like it's slipping. It's slipping fast away. And this is, you know, I mentioned in the last couple of vids that you got these characters, these, you know, Daily Mail journalists or BBC celebrities or, you know, Russell Brands and Elon Musks and these kind of characters who seem to be just again the metaphor is to they're gripping for all their worth, you know, fingertips, to hold on to the narrative that's just screaming away from them.
But here's the thing: it does work most of the time with most people. It doesn't work with you anymore. It doesn't work with me anymore. It doesn't work with Georgina. It doesn't work for a minority of us who've been through the fire, right? Now we tend to project that on every because we want to. We want to think we're winning. I mean, we tend to do that. But the reality is, look what happened to Georgina. She had the shit kicked out of her because she dared to step at a precise juncture. They exposed themselves because of how hard they came down on it. There's something about the Catholic Church in Wollongong, right up the port in Newcastle. It's the biggest coal export harbor in the world. It's owned by China. The whole east coast of Australia is being bought up by China, funded by the Catholic Church. So if you tread anywhere near a Catholic church in that area, like on the west coast of Canada, wham, you are crushed. And, it's not a matter of alternative paradigm. They use physical force to scare her so she won't come back. They're that vulnerable. So we have to make that different, designate between, or make a distinction between this tip of the spear, folks of like us, and the mass who are still waiting to be slaves again. They're just waiting for the right master to take them back into slavery. That's still the thinking. And I don't know if that's ever broken historically. It's an interesting question, whether the masses are able to really take power in their own name or whether it always comes down to a few of us kind of forcing the change. I don't know. I mean, I've always believed that, as a kind of basic egalitarian, that everybody can do it. But in practice, it doesn't tend to happen that way. So it's kind of a question mark for me.
Well, back to that holographic universe point you made a little earlier on, yeah. And looking at it from that long-term historical perspective, I don't know if you've seen the Albert Pike letters from the 1800s. That there was, I think he's a Grandmaster Freemason, but one of the underground secret networks that they're again very desperate to keep concealed and under the radar. But it was shown from the 1800s onwards how their strategy, their tactics would unfold throughout the 20th century, and it all culminates in this lockdown situation, totalitarian police state, authoritarian tyranny.
Do you think that the CIA and military intelligence agencies and the FBI have used the emergency provisions, both in law and by emergency agency, the Federal Preparedness Agency it's called now, to have contingency plans which threaten the liberty of American citizens?
Mr. Rowan, in due course, the committee will pass judgment on those questions. I'm not going to preguess the committee or prematurely attempt to pass judgment on this program. But let me tell you this. In the need to develop a capacity to know what potential enemies are doing, the United States government has perfected a technological capability that enables us to monitor the messages that go through the air. These messages are between ships at sea. They could be between military units in the field. We have a very extensive capability of intercepting messages wherever they may be in the airwaves. Now, that is necessary and important to the United States as we look abroad at enemies or potential enemies. We must know. At the same time, that capability at any time could be turned around on the American people. And no American would have any privacy left, such as the capability to monitor everything, telephone conversations, telegrams, it doesn't matter. There would be no place to hide if this government ever became a tyranny. If a dictator ever took charge in this country, the technological capacity that the intelligence community has given the government could enable it to impose total tyranny. And there would be no way to fight back, because the most careful effort to combine together in resistance to the government, no matter how privately it was done, is within the reach of the government to know. Such is the capability of this technology. Now, why is this investigation important? I'll tell you why. Because I don't want to see this country ever go across the bridge. I know the capacity that is there to make tyranny total in America. And we must see to it that this agency and all agencies that possess this technology operate within the law and under proper supervision, so that we never cross over that abyss. That's the abyss from which there is no return.
The question is, well, why? Why did they need that strategy from so far way back? Well, is it because there's this energetic ascension or development or progress that humanity is making that they know about. So you get into the esoterics and you read about, you know, what the ancient cultures knew about these big cycles, these great esoteric cycles, etheric cycles that happen, and if there's some validity to the idea that humanity, Armageddon and apocalypse, they both mean unveiling, right? That the truth vibrations come, and people become much more aware as it develops. So there's a synchronicity of their intensifying of the lockdown, or you know, the authorities' intensification of lockdown, that goes chronologically with the rise of humanity. And I really feel like that whole COVID situation has done us a big favor. You know, obviously it's been murderous in terms of deaths and these injections and this kind of stuff. But the awareness, okay, not everybody's quite as, you know, this tip of the spear, you say, but people have moved up rungs and they're asking questions. And once you've got a spark, a spur of inspiration along those lines, you can't unlearn it, right? Once you see the 3D right. picture in the hologram, you can't not see it again.
I think that's all true. And there's an added factor in that and I talked about this in some of the stuff I've been sending you in my book, Memoirs of a Revolutionary, where you look at, you know, liberal capitalism, industrial capitalism evolved naturally into what we call a corporatocracy. The system concentrates wealth and power more and more. National boundaries disappear. And you have a smaller elite running things economically. That's just the way it tends to evolve. At that point, it becomes more unstable because when you lose diversity in a system, whether it's economic or human or ecological, it tends to collapse more easily. So all the banks now are all connected. One crisis, right. Like you saw that in the States, two banks on the West Coast collapse. And the whole system starts getting into Biden's reacting. Everyone's nervous because it's also integrated. That can cause another collapse like in 1929. And the system needs those collapses because the authoritarianism, because it reconsolidates into bigger and bigger, more and more wealth for fewer and fewer people. But that's going to end in total destruction. So it's part of the evolution, the natural evolution of the system. My question is, how is it that people continually adapt themselves to that? Because we all do. Human beings are adaptive. And so whatever is the norm. And how do we really bring about a truly revolutionary, a different way of being when our natural impulse tends to be conservative and status quo? I mean, that's the eternal question. But I think it's these moments, and that brings us back to today and the Aboriginal Holocaust memorial events. It showed a clue as to how to change all that. Like we say, it relies on each one of us attaining that higher self where we're able to look beyond our conditioning and programming and bring in a new world and make it permanent, not just sporadic occupations of churches, but take back the power, right?
Yeah, I agree. There's a consolidation. You can see and feel and appreciate the consolidation of power that is being pulled together because it feels like, you know, when the castle's under attack, you go to the keep, right? And you got a lot less frontiers to defend yourself on because you can feel the pressure from all sides coming in. You know, just this week, doing discussions with the South Americans in the classroom, you know, some sparky, intelligent characters. And the dissolution with right and left politics. You go back, I don't know, 20 years, 25 years, everybody seemed to be, you know, either for the left or either for the right. But this generation coming through now, you know, the guys in the 20s and 30s, they just see it, what's the phrase, two wings of the same bird. They're not buying the divide and conquer like perhaps my generation used to. Right. And that, you know, it's healthy. It feels really healthy. You know, they're open to other possibilities. And going back to the COVID situation, 2021, I think back to when they went for me, when, you know, we're talking about Georgina and why they've gone for her. I think what I was doing was I was poking the stick or hitting the hornet's nest of those underground secret networks, particularly Satanism. You know, I was chatting with Samantha Baldwin. I was going right into the Wilfred Wong situation, and they couldn't deal with it. They had to physically nab me in order to shut me up because I was rattling the cage too much. That's what they've got to defend. So the COVID situation, I think they're trying to create the chaos of people, you know, pointing the finger at doctors, pointing the finger at politicians, pointing the finger at the obvious public representatives, in order to create the concealment chaos where the deeper international networks, your Freemasons, your Fabians, your Jesuits, whatever it is, the Satanists, they're the ones that they're being exposed now. They're feeling the pinch.
And like you describe left and right as two wings on the same bird, don't forget it's a one-dimensional description, and it really doesn't describe the multi-dimensional nature of life and politics. So, you know, it isn't left and right, it's also up and down. In any ideology or political party, you have totalitarian and libertarian elements. So you find the libertarians these days in America are all uniting across the old political differences. You find Republicans and Democrats both being upset about, you know, the corporatocracy and COVID and everything, and yet they're wedded to the old ideologies, right? That's bursting. And there's a new thing emerging, but it's a time of confusion, which is always what happens in an era of change. Things are very confusing. You know, one of the great anecdotes from the Russian Revolution is, you know, there's Lenin and the revolutionaries stuck in exile off in Switzerland. And a week before the revolution breaks out, they're all saying the same thing. You know, the Tsar's in the saddle for the next 50 years. You know, it's hopeless. And they're on the ground. The people blow that whole idea away by their own spontaneous action. And then the revolutionaries have to run to keep up with them. You know, that tends to be at those key moments in history. That's what happens. So we got to wait for those moments and be on the front lines with the people, not held back by dogma, right?
And I don't know about you, but I can feel that flashpoint coming. And you go back to that one, was in 1917, the Russian Revolution. And so there was the first wave of it. And then one of their guys, they attempted to shoehorn in Prince Lvov. Was that the name of the guy? Yeah, so there was a second one.
One of the old monarchists, liberal monarchists. Yeah, yeah.
Second one very quickly after that was clearly a sham shill attempt to shoehorn one of their guys in. And then he was busted, exposed, disclosed, whatever it is. And then a much more people-orientated wave of, like the earthquake. You have the pre-quakes, right? It's an earthquake.
Yeah, and you saw the reason it had to keep going further and further in a revolutionary direction is you had not only the provisional government, but over here you had the Soviets, which are the workers and peasants and soldiers' councils, direct democracy, like we're trying to build with the republic assemblies. And they were vying for power. And, you know, the revolutionaries eventually said, okay, all power to the Soviets. We don't need your old system anymore. Transfer power. You know, and that's really what made the final revolution, the fact that that happened. Now, that got defeated quickly for a lot of reasons, including, you know, the Allied intervention. They tried to crush the new revolutionary regime, the economy, invasion, you know, the civil war, all of that to deplete people so that you fall back naturally to the old conservative ways. And then you get a dictator like Stalin come in, like Napoleon or whoever, right? But that process is the same in every generation, and it's really fascinating to be part of it and be right in the center of it, watching it develop. It's a very exciting time we're in, right?
Yeah. Looking at the Irish situation, 1920s, there was an idea, and it was perhaps a sort of romantic illusion to a certain extent, that once you're rid of the English or the crown authorities, then, you know, it's the land of milk and honey, the bed of roses will arrive, because Irish people good, English people bad. And then, you know, as that movie shows, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, it wasn't so simple as that, because then other variables kicked in, such as you're alluding to here. You know, are we going to go fully egalitarian, or are we going to maintain this sort of hierarchy connected with finance and capitalism?
Keep the old system. Instead of Union Jack, you have the Irish tricolor flag, but it's the same system, right?
Yeah, and so with the Soviet Union, going back over to there, they tried to, stop me if I'm wrong, I think you're probably better equipped to answer this one than me, but they attempted to take away that nationalism gloss, that layer of nationalism, and the Internationale is a phrase that springs to mind. That's a song, is it?
Right. Kind of boiled down to the two wings, Trotsky, who believed in spreading the revolution internationally, and Stalin, who wanted to consolidate it, he called it socialism in one country, which of course is impossible. You can't be a sea of egalitarianism in a world of corporate monopoly, right? You do have to spread it. You do have to internationalize it. And that's especially now when the borders have vanished anyway, and there's the big corporate machine versus the people, basically, right? Everywhere.
And getting back to your guys on the streets in downtown Vancouver, you know, they'll be as aware as anybody. I'm thinking as kind of George Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, where they saw the, like you're talking about, the vertical pathogen, the hierarchical psychopathy, the psychological power over might is rights through financial exploitation. They'll see that as starkly as anybody from the street level, you know, the homeless level of the down and out situation. But creating that environment where your middle classes, for want of a better expression, that those people who have got pensions invested, those people who've got, you know, money wrapped up in property or whatever it is, jewelry or things like that, they'll be keen to hang on to a different ideology, even though they can see that the old system is fading away, the house of cards is falling. So how do you gel?
I don't know if you can gel, Owen. You know, like it's like wheat and chaff. It sifts out all the time, right? And you've got to go after the wheat and hold on to, you know, that, because I found that in setting up the assemblies. The problem was is that a lot of people in the first assemblies set up on Vancouver Island, they were very middle class, and their first question was, how do we hold on to what we have? Not how do we make it fair for everybody? They were just thinking of their own narrow self-interest. And when that was threatened, they all dropped away and allowed a few provocateurs to destroy the assembly. You got to go for the people who have a vested interest in the future, not the present, who have nothing in the present and need something new, right? And I remember I was with a native guy once. We were doing walkabouts in the downtown east side. We'd go out and try to rally homeless people like Georgina was just trying to do, right? And I remember this guy with me was a Latin American. He was a Guatemalan who had worked in the slums of Guatemalan City. And his whole base community being wiped out by the military. He was the only survivor. He came to Vancouver. And he said to one of the homeless guys, brother, the only thing I can offer you isn't food. It's the new society. That's what I really have to offer you, a new way of being together. Because I give you food now, it's gone. You're still in the same boat. Money, it doesn't matter. It doesn't change anything. It's like the Zapatista slogan in the Mexican Revolution in the 1980s. It said their slogan was, we don't want money. We don't want power. We want a new world. I love that. That sums it up, right?
Okay, that says it all. Yeah. And again, chatting with the Latinos that I'm with regularly at the moment, they were telling me about, you know, how everybody was aware over the last couple of decades of the massive corruption, how the interconnection between the politicos and the cartels, right, and this sort of mafioso overlord turf war, you know, who's got the biggest guns is in charge of the place. And that there's, I don't know if, you know, it's interesting because a couple of the guys were suggesting that it's heading north, perhaps to the southern states of the USA by now. Maras, M-A-R-A-S. Have you heard of these guys?
No.
So back to the 1920s, 1930s, when those democracies were insipid and you know, useless and clearly not fit for purpose, the big brother father figures turned up, your Mussolinis and your Stalins and your Hitlers, perhaps even the Churchills, and so people were looking for that strong leadership overlord character to you know, break up the criminality, smash the corruption, and make at least the streets safe to walk in. And yeah, you know, again, without going into too much details, a couple of the Central American guys are saying that, you know, the change now because of this Maras group is massive, that they have made the streets safe to walk in again.
But who are they? Yeah, criminal syndicate or something?
Right. They seem to be just the next wave, you know, of frightening overlords.
Mexico was run by criminal cartels, drug cartels. I mean, even the New York Times will say how the cartels determine who are the police. They run Mexico City. They run the government. You know, so, I mean, that's certainly the wave that over here you got the corporate system. It's like what happened when the Soviet Union collapsed. The criminal oligarchs took over, billionaire oligarchs, including Putin, right? Like it's that kind of old, medieval notion of the padrone, the boss, right? And everybody's subject to them, and he'll treat you nice or he'll kill you depending on how you act, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, it's that always that feudal thing alongside the liberation aspect, totalitarian liberation, right? In our minds and in the world, right?
And the big question is who's funding them, right? Where are they getting their arms from? Where are they getting capital to do that, and it's just the next wave of historical. So we got into an interesting discussion about, you know, what's the motivation for people to get up in the morning? You know, is it still fear? And you know, people are afraid of what might happen if they don't operate in the world, as opposed to being motivated through, you know, creativity, joy. You know, the good stuff.
Hard. It's hard in a narcissistic culture. We're taught to just be functional and not have meaning. You know, it's hard to develop a purpose in your life. It's not even fear so much as that inability to escape that self-oriented mind. There was a statistic that said 1/3 of young American girls are actively contemplating suicide. I mean, can you believe that? 1/3 of your young population want to kill themselves because there's no meaning to their life. I mean, you would think that'd be the overriding issue in society, right? But no, it's just kind of, oh, well, because you're really challenging the whole corporate system, which is there is no meaning. It's like my grandpa said in World War I, they had a song in the trenches. We're here because we're here because we're here because we're here. You know, and there is no meaning when you're in the trenches. You're just supposed to serve the machine. Well, eventually the human element says, I'm done. I'm out of here. Right. And that's what we're facing. That's, you know, it's a spiritual revival we need at a human level. That, you know, the meaning of life is not to serve some machine, but it's to take care of Mother Earth, to take care of each other, to deliver a higher cause. And that's what allows us to survive this big death camp, right?
Yeah. That's, you know, you talk about these teenagers, you know, teenage suicide is huge. I remember from when I was teaching in state schools back over on the Big Island, there would be teenage suicides, and it was getting to the point where, which was quite disturbing for me, where it just seemed like it was, oh, just one of those things. And you stop and you give yourself a bit of a slap and you think, shit, no, this is a child desolation with society is so overwhelming that they see no future in growing up at all and bumping themselves up. And then, What we have, and again, this is a knock-on throwback from the Christianity side of things, is that people then are invited to think, well, if you're not settled and you're not comfortable with the society you're in, you must be ill, or you must have some disease or illness, right, or mental disorder or something. So we're gonna sedate you, you know, pharmaceuticals, whatever it is, and we're gonna convince you that the problem is yours internally, biologically, whatever it is. As opposed to, you know, we spoke about this last time, you know, Jiddu Krishnamurti is no measure of health to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society. So perhaps these kids who are killing themselves are the healthiest of the bunch.
Well, that's right.
In a very perverse way.
Well, they're making a statement, we want to be free. And it isn't just in America. That's the third most common cause in the world today of death is suicide. So it's a global phenomena. And, you know, it's like when I got to know, going back to April 15th and our movement to expose the genocide in the Christian death camps in Canada, constant comment you got in the, quote, healing circles, from Native people was, oh, well, I had to carry a knife when I was 5 years old to defend myself. Like, imagine a little five-year-old kid in bed with a knife to defend themselves. And a lot of them would just kill themselves with a knife because they couldn't deal it. A five-year-old felt the need to kill themselves rather than be raped and tortured every day, right? So we're all going through a rape and torturing, you know, just living in this madhouse. You have it, when you conform to a system of murder, you're diminished and you lose all sense of anything. And that's the tragedy of people ignoring the lessons of our campaign, because it's a way out of that madness, right?
Yeah. And that's what I am at the moment. The crux for me is, yeah, I've got this evidence and these witnesses, you know, Samantha Baldwin's of this world. And I'm wanting these groups, for want of a better word, these collections of people to say, you know, take that on board, create a banner of these incidents involving, you know, hideous brutality of children. And let's make some waves with that as our standard bearer, you know.
Yeah.
But they want to go elsewhere. They want to, you know, talk about, you know, rates of interest on council.
Keep it distant. Keep it abstract. Keep it abstract and distant. It's safer that way, personally. There's nothing more threatening to any of us than talking about children being tortured, because all of us were, in one way or another, as kids.
Right. Right.
It hits close, and I knew that early in this campaign. That's why we had to broaden it all the time. It did not just children, but the system behind it. And, you know, it. But that's a big hurdle to get over. And once you do get over it, you're very empowered by it, though, because you've overcome, like William Coombs did in that church. He overcame that fear, inculcated at a young age, and then he was all powerful. That's why they had to physically kill him.
Okay.
That's the lesson given to all of us, right? Whether we act on it or not is up to us.
Yeah. The complex is the parable of the Good Samaritan, right? Everybody's walking across on the other street.
Yeah, and it doesn't allow to stop. It isn't allowed who stop, right, and help. But when you have to, more people do it. And that's the thing, you know, we always find the people who are out there occupying those churches with us weren't doing it as a good intention, because they had a humanitarian impulse, which you can take or leave, right? Their lives depended on it. They were getting killed every day, and they had to confront this machine that was killing them. That's why they took part in this. And that's why I had to, because my life had been gutted. What did I have left to lose, right? My kids were taken. I couldn't work. They blackballed me. Well, screw them. Then I'll go for the jugular here, guys. That's what Sun Tzu says. Never back your enemy into a corner, because then they come out and when Sun Tzu says, deliberately put your army and your soldiers into an inescapable situation. And that way they find their true resolve and courage when they know they're going to die. Then they fight even stronger. And that's what the system doesn't understand. They keep backing us into that corner. Well, that helps us. Yeah. Thank you very much. Right.
Right. My point a little earlier on about the COVID situation has done exactly that, I believe, to a lot more people than is good for the maintenance of what they're trying to hold together, the house of cards. And, you know, again, it brings me to this question about who's actually –